All right, so here's the deal. Things are changing fast in the tech world and the internet marketing world. And that's a big deal because you have to know which trends to stay on top of in order to market better, in order to acquire customers for cheap, and so you can run your business as efficiently as possible. Staying on top of all those trends is a pain in the butt, though. And so the folks at HubSpot have made this amazing report. It has a very official sounding name because it is a very official document. It's the 2024 State of Marketing Report. They've looked at millions, tens of millions of bits of data to find the top marketing trends that have the most immediate impact on your business. And so what HubSpot did was they surveyed over 1,400 marketing pros from across the world, and they looked at what are people using effectively, what's not working, more importantly, and they've been able to compile it in a really easy to read document. So if you want to learn ways how to optimize for social or how to boost engagement or how to strike the right balance between privacy but still being personal with your customers, go to HubSpot.com/state of marketing to get the free copy, or just Google HubSpot State of Marketing and it'll come up. Check it out. So before we get into this, I got to ask the listeners and you something. So Jack, our friend Jack Smith, introduced me to this guy a few years ago. And I don't even want to say what the service is yet. But I think I could say a little bit. There's a ride sharing service, one of the ride sharing services. And what this guy does is I think this is how he does it. I don't exactly know. But you can buy discounted credits,
right?
So you know how
I pay $20 and I get $40 worth of rides.
Have you done it?
So he showed it to me years ago, right? This was like, I don't know how long, 2 years ago maybe, he showed it to us, and I was like, oh great, I take rides all the time, would love to. Then as I went through the website, I was like, is this a scam? I don't think so, because Jack said he's doing it and he recommended it.
I've done it,
but then I was like, is this going to get my account banned? Like, this is too good to be true. So my skepticism went off. I didn't do it. I forgot about it. And then he posted about it in our private My First Million Facebook group. He said, hey, did you guys know about this? It's a really cool, clever hack and system that this guy's created. Jack loves those things. So tell me more about what's got your eye here.
Yeah. So he has this service. Now he's doing it for similar things. And okay. So Jack was like, hey, you should have this guy on the podcast. And I'm like, okay, so pros, this guy is a hustler. He's doing amazing stuff. And I'm pretty sure, I think he's either said it or I figured it out. I'm pretty sure the way he does it, this guy's in India. I think what he does is he has a network of like thousands of teenagers and kids, and he just gives them a first ride on a ride service, and he gets the $10 back like in referral and then sells it.
Right. So he's gaming the, it's not, as far as I understand, it's not like illegal. There's no like sort of illicit hacking or anything. He just says, hey, they have a referral system, which is cool. You get every time you refer somebody, you get a certain amount of credits. And what he realizes, he can do cheaper, maybe shorter rides in India. And that will count as a new customer that's been referred. And so he can give you in the U.S., your full credit for a lightweight ride there, and the arbitrage, there's some money. He keeps some money and we get a saving. And then the person who takes the ride gets a free ride. So it's like a win-win-win for everybody but the service.
And to add to complexity, if you pay with Bitcoin, you get a bigger discount, which is what I've done. And if you like do XYZ, like it looks incredibly shady. Long story short, it's interesting. It's a cool story. It's not a scam, but it's questionable about the ethics. And so do we want to promote this or not?
Of course. It's not promoting it. I am interested in this guy's story. And I think a lot of people would be interested in it. You can make your own judgment after you hear him out as to,
well, yeah, we've been called out for promoting unethical behavior.
Yeah, but people will call you out for whatever. I don't think we're promoting anything. It's one thing. Okay, it's promoting if we say, this is awesome, go do this. Okay, that's fair. But that's an opinion, right? But I think the right thing to do is to say, hey, here's somebody who's doing something interesting. They found a way to hustle and create a business for themselves as well as value for others. We should hear them out and then let people judge for themselves. Is this like past the gray area and not cool for them? Or is this actually like, fine? And so I think that's, we should leave that up to the listener. But our job is to tell the story. And also, I'm curious, so why not have them on? Who cares if
people get mad at us? Capital J journalist. All right. Well,
He messaged you and I. We'll set it up. I don't even know if he speaks English well enough. I guess we'll find out.
Right. Yeah, we'll find out. We'll bring him on. So I had some other of these. These are more like actual scams, but I wanted to talk about them. I don't know why. I wanted to just tell you some things that I've seen. Okay, so recently, I don't know if you've seen on YouTube or if it's just in my recommendations, but all day, every day, there's a live stream of Chamath Palihapitiya, who's kind of like a known investor, early Facebook guy, billionaire. It's like Chamath talking about Bitcoin, and it has always like 40, 50,000 live viewers watching it at any given time. And it says Bitcoin giveaway, Chamath Bitcoin giveaway. And what they did, so what someone's doing, which is just totally a scam, they have a stream going. They have a video embedded of Chamath talking about Bitcoin from like 5 years ago. It's not Chamath doing this, by the way. He's trying to get it taken down. And then on the screen, it says, Bitcoin giveaway, send me your address and I'll send Bitcoin to somebody. And I think they're just making money off the ad revenue of this live stream. And it has like 40, 50,000 people. I'm sure some of that's bot traffic and some of it is real traffic. But it's hilarious that somebody's doing this. Like, A, what a waste of time. And B, it's hilarious that YouTube allows this. Chamath's trying to take it down. But A, okay, so that's one little thing I noticed. Here's another one. You know when the US government came out with the kind of PPP, like, hey, if you're unemployed or you're an employer and you have people, you can get access to money. So, of course, the Nigerian sort of scammers came out and they actually took out $100 million from the system. I don't know if you heard about this.
No.
They just filed as either unemployed people or employers of unemployed people, employers
who
qualify for PPP. The sort of Nigerian scam ring.
It's called the 409 scam, I think it's called.
Is that the name of the program?
Is that like the country code of it? So a lot of these guys are based out of Lagos, Nigeria, I think.
Okay.
And I believe that they're there because for some reason it's part of, I don't know how it got embedded into that particular culture where it became a thing. But I think, I also think that there's not really strict laws around, like there's a lot of loopholes in law that you can not get punished.
So this guy totally scammed, or this group of people scammed out $100 million out of the government, out of the U.S. government, while the U.S. government was giving away money for like in a really intense 2 week, 3 week frenzy. Abreu just linked some guy in from Wikipedia, Emmanuel Nwude. I don't know how you say his name, but he sold an airport for $240 million. He didn't own this airport. He just sold it, which is crazy. So there's that. And then here's some other ones that I thought were interesting. So, you know, super PACs, like the political fundraising thing, which sort of like gets around the normal donation limits for individuals.
Yeah, it's like they like form a company or a fund and you give money to the fund and that fund's allowed to
donate a larger quantity of money, right? So they're super PACs for every cause. So my friend Jason had this hilarious idea. He didn't do this, but he was just like, he's very politically minded and he hated super PACs because he's like, oh God, like it's the super PACs who get behind, let's say the gun lobby or whoever that like fund these things that I don't agree with necessarily. And I just think super PACs are kind of shady. There's lack of transparency, blah, blah, blah. And then he sort of had this idea of like, if you can't beat him, join him. So he was like, I know what I'll do. And I thought this was a hilarious idea. He's like, for every issue, I'm just going to spin up two super PACs, one taking each side. And I'm just going to raise all the money I can for both sides. And I'm going to take a cut of both sides of it for every issue. He's like, until they shut down super PACs. And I thought that was a hilarious way to fight super PACs.
Do you remember at Founders Dojo where I used to work out of, it was like this office that was kind of like Ehrlich Bachman on the TV show Silicon Valley. I think Dave did something like this where he created a donation thing. Who was running? Trump versus Obama, Trump versus Hillary. And he created something where he was like, pledge your support to Hillary. And then he also had a pledge your support for Trump. Like, he did both of those things.
Yeah, exactly. There's all kinds of crazy stuff. I don't know. I don't know why I needed to bring up a bunch of fake scams.
Who's the wealthiest person who you know who got money off of like a shady way?
I got to think about that. Do you have one?
I don't know if this is shady, but I have a bunch of friends that have made a lot of money, like $30, $40, $50 million off of what I consider to be borderline unethical internet marketing practices. Like, for example, who have run call centers. Like, you know how you get a phone call from like Marriott hotels? Mm-hmm. It's not really from Marriott. It's like, or, you know, if you, I knew a guy who had a company.
Wait, hold on. So it's not really from Marriott. And then what?
I don't know how the scam works. I get the calls all the time, but they'll say like, you know, you won this, you won, like, it's basically they're selling you travel packages.
I see.
Like, you were picked from a random drawing to get a discount on a all-exclusive trip to Sandals. So it's, right. That's not unethical. It's just obnoxious. And then I know a guy who made a bunch of money off a co-registration company. So, like, when you sign up on Expedia, they sell your email address to 18 other travel stuff. And he was the middleman, and he made like $50 million and bet it all on in the stock market in one big.
Okay. The closest, the first thing that came to mind, or the closest thing that came to mind, I don't actually know this person, but I, you know the guy's kid, and this is the dad. So this guy, Naveen Jain, who,
oh, I know him,
CEO of this thing called InfoSpace back in the day. And it, like, during the dot-com boom, InfoSpace was like, you know, riding high. And then, you know, sort of overnight, InfoSpace crashes, but he had sort of sold out, or, you know, protected his own interest right before the crash, and was like, you know, everybody lost their jobs and their 401ks in the company. And this guy was like a billionaire. And so that was sort of shady. And then he started this thing called Intellius after the fact. I think that's the name of it.
Yeah. And it had a similar outcome.
Intellius is this like shady thing where you would sign up for a free credit check, I think, or it's like back, you could find information from public records about people or about yourself. I don't remember exactly what the product was, because I don't spend too much time, you know, like thinking about this stuff. But basically, there was this tiny checkbox at the bottom, which was like, cool, you got this free credit check, but then we're going to charge you $20 a month, just kind of on subscription after that for blah, blah, some bullshit. And so they were making millions and millions of dollars, and people were all like, wait, what am I getting? I just paid like $200 this year for Intellius. What does that mean? What is this? And people kind of screenshotted the flow and showed how, like, you know, size 4 font the fine print was that you're going to get charged for this thing. And so that was pretty bad.
Yeah. That guy claims to be a billionaire.
Yeah, exactly. And he's a pretty like kind of crazy charismatic guy. And he's now got this like company that's about going to the moon, like a rockets company and all kinds of stuff. But he's definitely, you know, behind that smile, there's definitely like some skeletons or some baggage. Like, you know, neither of those two stories, InfoSpace or I think it's called Intellius, neither of those seemed like the most up and up companies.
Well, let's talk about some legit companies.
All right, so I'll do one. So this one actually comes also from Jack. So this is sort of the Jack episode. He's the guest, but we don't have him here. So he was talking a little bit about baseball cards. And I know baseball cards are hot right now because Gary Vee's been really pumping baseball cards and talking about baseball cards all the time. And so baseball cards are like a collector's item. They have value. They appreciate over time. It's, you know, like many, many goods of that kind. Now, one thing that's a common problem for people who are buying, selling, and trading baseball cards is the actual receiving of the, you know, you receive a shipment, you have to open it up, you hope it's not damaged, you have to verify that it's real, and then if you sell it, you got to sort of go through that whole shipping process right back to the other person, hope that nothing goes wrong in the process. And so for people who are collecting these as a sort of financial asset in some ways, and they're not like sitting there trying to carry them with them to school or something like that. You don't need the physical card. He was saying, why is there not sort of a central repository where you can
like a safety deposit,
a Fort Knox for the baseball cards, where basically you buy and sell it online, but it never moves. It just sort of exchanges ownership, but it's all stored in this central vault where it's cooled properly so they don't degrade. They're all verified by a professional there who's centrally located. You don't have to deal with any of the shipping costs or potential issues there. Yeah, so I think it's a pretty clever idea, and obviously could extend to sneakers, could extend to art, could extend to other things. Maybe there's something that, like this, that exists. I don't do baseball cards or art. Do you dabble with any of this stuff?
I got into shoes after I learned about them. We wrote about it on Trends about a year ago, and I've since gotten into them. Yeah, but not to the point of wanting to make money off of it, but to the point of like spending $300 on a pair. But I did do research on this, and it seems as though there's not a great solution. So Jack's onto something. We wrote about this actually. Heritage Auction House. What I would do if I wanted to create this, which I actually think this is a wonderful idea. I certainly don't have time, so I'm not going to, but this is a great idea. And what I would maybe do is contact a lot of the auction houses and be like, what are you guys doing now?
Right.
Why can't this work? And
Or collectors, high-end collectors, people who have a portfolio of these things. Because I think it is a very small, it's a niche community, obviously. It's a small number of people.
I don't think it's as niche as you think.
My point is that the kind of circle of influence is pretty tight here, where the number of people you would need to convince and that you could go learn from to see if this is a real problem is kind of small. And that's great. It's like kind of like online poker where you just go get these 15 pros to do something. And now they sway the rest of the casual community with them as like, oh yeah, that's the best practice. That's how we do things now.
It's pretty interesting and I love it. And I like it's, I wonder, I would have to imagine this has significantly better economics or maybe not than storage. So do you know how the companies like Clutter are doing?
I always assume that those companies are on the verge of failure. Now, I don't know if they, and I think Omni actually, it's like everything's going great. We keep raising money. We keep adding high profile people and we shut down. Like that's how these companies tend to go. Or they break out, you know. But
yeah, but do you know that Public Storage? You know the company Public Storage?
Public Storage is huge, yeah.
It's the most profitable company on the stock market.
Is that right?
By,
that's a pretty cool claim. Is that
by margin. So it like does $4 billion in revenue and like $2 billion in net income.
Interesting.
Yeah, okay. It's like the most profitable thing. Now, they don't do all this high-cost shit that all the new startups do where they like want to bring you your stuff. They just say like, here's a room. Bring right. your stuff. It's yours. Give us $100 a month. but it could be it's a really cool idea. That's my point. And so also another thing, I'm sure a lot of people know this, but I was ignorant and I didn't know this. But these storage companies, they're real estate businesses.
Yes.
It's just a way to get profit to buy real estate.
A great book I read when I was in college that inspired me. I was like on the verge of going down the real estate track rather than entrepreneurial track or the sort of startup-y track. And it's called Confessions of a Real Estate Entrepreneur. It's an awesome book if you're a total noob and you're just curious about how the hell do people make money. It's not about the terms and the tactics and all that stuff. It's this one guy being like, I wanted to make it in real estate. So he's like, my first deal, I had no money and I found this warehouse. And then I negotiated this and he just walks through deal by deal for like 10 deals of Confessions of a Real Estate Entrepreneur. And one of them was about storage. And you know, the whole game with real estate is you sort of need to see value where others don't. So other people look at this 25,000 square foot warehouse and they say, okay, warehouses are valued at X dollars per square foot. So this building is worth Y. And what you need to say is, hey, if I subdivided this warehouse into tiny storage units and I add it all up, now it's worth, you know, X plus Y dollars per square foot is more, it's worth more. So I can go buy it. I can actually pay more than the guy next to me because I know I can get more value out of it than that person can because I know how to change use or add value in some way. That's what WeWork did. They took office floors and say, hey, what if we subdivided it and rented this out by the desk? And so that's like a common real estate strategy. And that's what storage units are.
And if anyone listening to this, I think some people will get mad at me. Real estate has the highest ratio of rich and dumb people. Like,
right. Yes.
You know what I'm saying? Where it's
I know
like the
exactly
highest,
what you're saying.
It's got the highest ratio of low IQ rich people.
Yes, that's very true. Doesn't mean if you do real estate, you're low IQ. It means there are more wealthy people in real estate who are not superstar geniuses who, you know, work themselves
normal, just normal, smart, hardworking people.
Right. A normal, smart, rational person who obviously had some skills, took some risks, but there are more wealthy people in real estate that way. If you just said, hey, Sean, you know, in the next 10 years, you die if you don't get wealthy, I'd be like, cool, go into real estate. Like that's my best path. My highest likelihood chance of becoming wealthy is through real estate versus any other sort of venture.
Yeah, it's the highest dumb people to rich people job I've ever seen in my life.
I love it. Okay, so that's Jack's idea, which is sort of Fort Knox for baseball cards. I like it. What else we got?
Are we going to talk about hay? Did we talk about hay? I don't think we did.
We didn't. Go for it.
Okay. By the way, this look at what I'm drinking here. I drink these all day. You see that? It's called Heineken Zero. It's not it's not the same as non-alcoholic beer. It's zero alcohol beer. They're awesome.
Wait, what do you mean it's not the same as non-alcoholic beer? What's the difference?
I don't know the legality, but I drink a lot of non-alcoholic beer because I like beer. The normal non-alcoholic beer says it has less than 0.5% alcohol. This has 0.0. Heineken said that this is their fastest growing category.
And you like it?
I love it. I'll drink four a day.
So what's in it that makes it taste? Does it taste like beer or it tastes like something else?
They call it a malt and yeast beverage. It's a unique recipe. It has 0% alcohol. It's brewed with pure malt and special A yeast, just like the original Heineken lager beer. It has the same taste, but without the alcohol.
Dude, that's hilarious. They sell the same product without the expensive ingredient and can charge the same for it. It's like, here, well, let's give you less.
Ingredients: water, malted barley, hop extract, and natural flavor. That's all it is. So, oh man, I love these. I drink them like crazy. They're awesome. Okay. We did talk about hay a little bit, but what did you want to talk about?
I just wanted to sort of call out the sort of marketing side of things, of what they do. So have you read the book Rework, which is the 37 Signals book?
Years ago. They basically say that, like, one of the marketing principles that they talk about is, like, to have an enemy, right?
Yeah. I think there's a chapter called Pick a Fight. And I want to read it. So let me see if I can pull it up real quick. Okay. So here's a section of it. If you think a competitor sucks, say so. When you do that, you'll find others who agree with you and rally to your side. Being the anti-blank is a great way to differentiate yourself and attract followers. For example, Dunkin' Donuts positions itself as the anti-Starbucks. Its ads mock Starbucks for using, you know, these fake Italian words, you know, instead of just saying small, medium, large. Or they'll do a campaign like they made a site called DunkinBeatStarbucks.com where visitors can send e-cards with statements like, "Friends don't let friends drink Starbucks." Audi is another example. It takes on the old guard of car manufacturers. It puts old luxury brands like Rolls-Royce and Mercedes on notice by touting how it's a fresh alternative. Apple jabs at Microsoft with ads that compare Mac and PC owners, et cetera, et cetera. All these examples show the power and direction you can gain by having a target in your sights. Who do you want to take a shot at? You can even pit yourself as the opponent of an entire industry. Dyson's Airblade starts with the premise that the hand dryer industry itself is a failure and then positions itself as a faster, more hygienic option. I Can't Believe It's Not Butter puts the enemy right in its own name. Having an enemy gives you a great story to tell your customers. Taking a stand always stands out. People get stoked by conflict. They take sides. Passions are ignited. It's a good way to get people to take notice. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm down. Right now, my enemy is the New York Times a little bit. And basically, journalists who say they don't have a bias, but like they can't admit that they do. So yeah, I'm down with that. And with Hay.com, I call it Hay.com. I think it's working well. I think that
so they picked I think initially they picked just traditional email like Gmail as the enemy for being like cluttered. You just keep getting spammed by random things. It's email you don't want. It's a headache. And now they picked Apple, and it was a way better fight to pick because it's a more novel story and it doesn't seem as self-serving as when they picked Gmail as the competitor.
And I like that. I actually like these guys a lot. And so I'm going to talk shit about them a little bit, but in general, I really like them and I respect them. But I do think that it's a little lame what they, like, some of these moves are a little bit lame because they also pick a fight with like mainstream startups about giving equity when they're like make millions of, these guys probably make 10 million, 15 million a year in profit and they're very, very wealthy. And I feel like it's a little hypocritical.
So they on Twitter, people are calling this beef marketing. So just to have a beef with everybody, just to keep your name relevant. And there's always going to be some people that agree with your side of the story. So for example, against the startup industry, they are anti-VC, don't take funding, be profitable.
Which is weird because they've taken funding from Jeff Bezos.
Right. But on the whole, they don't play the sort, they are profitable and they don't play the sort of raise the A, B, C, D, E, like sort of get big IPO. So they picked that fight. They picked the fight of, you don't need to work 80 hours a week. 30 is enough. Be productive. Just be smart. Don't kill yourself. You don't have to be a workaholic.
He tweeted the other day that they are working through the weekend to resolve all the issues.
Right. But I'm saying in general, I'm not saying these are correct. I'm saying these are the fights that they easily trigger people, just like they triggered you just now. Then they also do like
They take summers off, which is part of their kind of like don't be a workaholic thing. And they have one more, which is sort of like don't depend on any platform. So like don't be dependent on anybody. And these platforms,
I get it, and I like a lot of their philosophy. I just think it's stupid when you make rules. You know what I mean? Like when you make rules around something, it's like, dude, not everything has a rule. Like a lot of times, like you can't say that you are anti-VC. I'm not anti-VC at all.
Right.
I'm just like pro, like let's be logical and let's look at a variety of options.
Right. But that doesn't sell, right? So if you just looked at it in terms of like, if you just said they're doing all of this for marketing purposes, if you believe that to be true, then what they've done is incredibly effective. It's sort of like Buffer, right? Maybe you don't agree that you should transparently put all your company salaries and revenue and losses out there publicly. But if you looked at it like marketing, it's been undeniably effective at marketing the company.
No, I'm on board. I think, look, it's working for them. I just think that some of their opinions are bullshit, but I like them a lot. And I think that it's incredibly effective for them.
So why don't you pick more fights? That was kind of my takeaway when I saw this. I feel like you guys could do way more of this.
I think we should.
And so like, let's come up with a game plan right now. So
I just picked a fight with a guy today. Did you see my Twitter?
Yeah. Okay. I'm looking at your Twitter right now. So you picked a fight with this 2VLDY. Is that the person?
Yeah.
So what is this? Tell me what happened.
They copied my landing page. They copied trends completely. And they're full of shit. And I emailed them and told them to fuck off. And they like try to justify it. I'm like, no, you're lying. Like, I just looked you up on Web Archive. You just copied our page. Like, I see when we launch and then when you launch, you
right.
Word for word ripped us off.
That's okay. So you picked a fight with them.
But that's actually, if you look at like what the rules are of this game, that's actually a bad fight. You don't pick a fight exactly. with people littler than you. You got to pick a fight. So who should I, what should I do, you think?
Well, you said New York Times. So first I was thinking, because you guys have as a competitor, like Morning Brew, right? So like they they're kind of similar size. And that's one that could be more like PewDiePie versus T-Series, where the feud actually would help both sides grow. So that's more like wrestling, where you could be like, cool, I'm going to attack you, you attack me. This is just going to generate a bunch of buzz. It's sort of like the Barstool Caller Daddy thing, where it's like both sides end up more popular and through the drama. So like that's one that I think you guys could do. The other one would be more like against the mainstream media, which could be New York Times. Now, there has to be some level of authenticity to it. So it's got to be something you genuinely do believe. Like it could be the thing that like, why are you guys pretending like you're not biased? But that doesn't tell a great story about you guys and what you do. It's not that you guys are like, it's not that the value prop of The Hustle is to be opinionated clearly and be subjective, not even try to be objective. I don't think that's like what y'all do. So I think you got to pick a fight that A, makes sense, B, is polarizing, and C, somehow tells the story of what The Hustle is all about by being the opposite of the thing you're hating on.
I thought about making fun of the Skim because I think they're like a joke, but then I was like, I don't know if I would win that fight.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's something here because I think in general, you do have strong opinions about things, but I don't see that come through via The Hustle, maybe intentionally. Maybe you've censored it, maybe you haven't, but I think you guys can do well with this.
No, I'm not in favor of censorship. How about this? Let me a small tangent. Something that we're testing and I'm thinking about launching is I'm pretty obsessed with the idea of expert opinion as opposed to journalist opinion. And one thing I'm testing is I've built this network of like 1,000 experts, and every day we're emailing them stories and getting their opinion, and we're going to just publish their opinion. We're not going to touch it. We're not going to edit it. We're just going to say, here's exactly what they said.
Right.
And that's interesting to me. And I'm going to get people to pay money for it.
Yeah. I think that's actually pretty dope.
It's like a private Twitter.
I saw the like mock-up you guys did. I didn't love that, but I love the idea of this because when I think about it, this actually what I care about. I care about what do the people who actually know their shit think about this, and not the journalist with their opinion, the editor with their agenda, the journalist talking to an expert and then like siphoning off one quote and having that be, you know, that fitting into some narrative. I just like, let's say it's the, like right now the NBA is about to resume and there's a big debate. Should they come back or should they not come back? Some of the players don't want to come back because of coronavirus. Some of the players don't want to come back because it takes away from the Black Lives Matter movement. And there's all these ESPN talking heads that talk about this. Like there's literally this guy, Brian Windhorst, who's like, you know, the opposite of a basketball player. He's like a short, fat, white guy who's never played basketball. And he's always talking about what should happen, what shouldn't happen. And I'd rather just be like, cool, the ping goes out to all the NBA players. And here's the 80 responses we got back. LeBron said this. I don't know if it's anonymized or if it's with their name, but that would be way more interesting to me. It's like, here's what they actually think.
Yeah, so that's what I'm thinking about building, or it's what we're attempting to build. And in that case, the enemy to me is clear. It's just like
journalism as a whole.
Journalism, because yeah. When you think about it, like,
we don't need you. You're
everyone with
man.
A phone is a journalist. And I hate when I hate the fact that journalism is a circle jerk on Twitter. Like, they only want to impress each other. They don't want to impress their audiences. Like, you have to, like, what I tell our team, I'm like, guys, we don't serve each other. We serve our readers. Like, we are their waiters. We are their servants. We exist to give them information. And my team, who has worked at a variety of places, are like, well, that's so different than other places, because it's all about how do we win awards, or right. How do we do this or that. And I'm like, yeah, that baffles me that is the thing. So that's our enemy for that.
Yeah. Okay. I like that. I think that could be good. Cool. Pick a fight. I like it. Okay. I have another random idea or thing to talk about. So we both like this comedian, Chris D'Elia, and he was a funny guy. We thought he was great.
The best. At least
I'll speak for myself. Yeah. I don't know how you felt, but we thought he was hilarious. Whatever. He's a comedian.
I thought he was the best. I've seen him live a couple times.
And I listened to his podcast a bunch. That's one of the few podcasts I listen to. Anyways, last week gets exposed as sort of like a creep. And so a bunch of people come out and say, hey, Chris D'Elia was messaging me when I was, you know, 17, 16 years old, and asking me for nude pictures and all this bad stuff, right? So a whole bunch of people come out at once. Turns out Chris D'Elia is creeping around, or allegedly creeping around. And so this comes out. He's sort of getting canceled right now. So two questions for you. What was your reaction when that happened? And then I have an idea based on that.
My reaction was, if I was even bummed that he was accused. And the evidence was
pretty damning.
Strong.
Pretty
and
damning.
So I believe it to be true. And in my head, I think, well, fuck you. Like, you're the worst. So... I feel pissed off because I was a huge, huge, huge fan. And I don't know. I'll still listen to his jokes, but I will not like support him financially.
Yeah. So that was my other question. Well, if you're listening to him, you're still supporting him in some way.
I guess so. Right. But I don't know if I would pay money to go see him.
Right. So that's kind of my other question is, and nobody really talks about this. It's sort of like, cool, I'm a fan, or you're canceled. But I think in reality, you know, as so many people, this is, you know, two of my favorite comedians, Louis C.K. and Chris D'Elia, both came out to be doing really creepy, messed up behavior. But there's also people who are clearly still fans of Louis C.K. They're probably not fans of what he did, but they're still fans of him. They'll still listen to his stuff. They'll go to his shows. And I was wondering, how do you deal with that kind of like being torn between like, well, you don't like what they did, and maybe you don't even like the person, but you kind of like their art, you know, like, I don't know. Do people still watch
still
the Cosby
like it.
Show or
so
whatever,
like,
you know?
Yeah, I still watch the Cosby Show. I listen to R. Kelly. I love Michael Jackson music. Here's my logic.
Right.
Here's with great people who achieve greatness, who are like world class at their craft, are 9 out of 10 times fucking weird, and hopefully only weird. Sometimes they're also bad people.
Right.
And I just accept that, like, the people who I like are also good. There's a great quote where it says, like, every great man's a bad man. And in this case, it is incredibly true, where, like, he's with all this great stuff, he just has also done a ton of bad shit. So I still, like, will absolutely listen to his stuff, but I won't. I think he's a piece of shit.
Right. Isn't that weird? I'm sort of in the same boat. I don't know how to feel. That's why I brought it up. Because I'm like,
that's not weird. I mean, if you like, surely, like, I don't know. I don't even like it in political, but maybe like Chick-fil-A. It's like, dude, my taste buds don't know that you hate gays.
Right.
So it's like, it's hard. You know, I could disagree with you, but still enjoy your stuff. Right.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, with all that's coming out, everybody's going to have to figure out how they're going to deal with this, because your favorite something, musician, athlete, comedian, politician, one of your favorites is going to go down for being a total either asshole, creep, criminal, bad guy. You know, something's going to come out, and I think everybody's going to have to ask themselves, cool, how am I going to deal with that? Am I going to still consume their stuff that I like, or am I going to protest it? Am I going to think they're a piece of shit? Am I going to be conflicted? What's going to happen?
It's like, you know, Martin Luther King's one of my heroes, but he also cheated on his wife a lot.
Right.
Or that's like the rumor. So it's like,
yeah, I had heard about that. That's really crazy. Apparently, I just learned about this, but like the FBI was tracking him for a while because he was seen as sort of like a potential enemy of the state. And they like bugged his hotel rooms or whatever. There's reportedly, no one's seen this, I guess, but there's reportedly tapes of him sleeping with like 40 different women, you know, outside of his marriage, and participating in, you know, some sort of sexually deviant activities. But he's Martin Luther fucking King, right? And he's got like, you know, a day named after him and everything else.
Yeah. So that's what my opinion is. Just like everyone who's great is also bad in another person's perspective, and you just got to take the whole person.
Right. Okay. So the idea I had off this was actually a WikiLeaks for creeps, because one of the things that was really disturbing that came out of this was not just, oh, this guy I thought was cool, I liked, turns out to be not so cool, and I don't like what he did. But it was like a lot of these text messages were from like 10 plus years ago. And so, and same thing with like a lot of the people that get canceled, like the Bill Cosby stuff, a lot of that stuff I think was happening like in the 90s or something like that. And it takes sometimes decades for the stuff to come out. And I think that's a shame because, you know, A, the person sort of gets away with it and continues to harm other people or sort of, you know, be a, you know, a menace in society is out on the loose as long as these things stay secret. But I understand why people don't expose things, because then they get tied up and wrapped up in it. And, you know, you could see the girls who came out and said something about Chris D'Elia, their Twitter, they're getting attacked by his fans who are like, you know, well, why'd you send them the picture? And like stupid stuff like that. And so I think there needs to be sort of a WikiLeaks for creeps, where there is a way to dump anonymously evidence and claims against people. And then there needs to be some sort of like verifying function, like a set of journalists, kind of like the people who went and studied the Panama Papers and like dug into it and try to figure out what's real, what's not. But like a guaranteed sort of anonymity layer so that, you know, information can get out faster. What do you think of that?
As long as there's a trustworthy third party to verify, I'm into it. It's right. Just so easy to accuse people of doing bad stuff.
Totally. And that's the reason this can't be a company, because you'll just die of sort of libel and slander, you know, like because anything that turns out not to be true, you get sued out of existence. I think there was like there was an app that used to rate guys. I think it's called Lola or Lala. Or
I remember that. Like this. I remember that. My roommate was rated on it, and it said like,
not so nice shit, things.
Cheated on me and like small dick. And I was like, oh, dude, that sucks. I was like, I'm sorry, right? I mean, that sucks.
And so, yeah, like, I think you can't really do this as a company, but I think for society, it would be good if there's a way for people to be able to come forward about bad behavior better, for a whistleblower network to come forward, and not just about like how WikiLeaks is about sort of documents around certain things, but actually around, you know, racism, sexual harassment, things like that. I think there needs to be something like this. And obviously I haven't put a lot of thought into this. I'm not an expert about this stuff, but when I saw that it takes 10 years to come out, I'm like, something's broken.
Yeah. It is crazy that like Hannibal Buress joked about that Bill Cosby thing. And his joke was something like, what? Everyone knows this. Everyone right. knows this guy.
Harvey Weinstein. Everybody yeah. knew that.
Like everyone, we all talked about this. We all right. know this. And it's like, whoa, 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 what? I didn't know this. This is crazy. like I wish I would have. I agree with that. I also think that there's a lot of room to deconstruct Wikipedia. I think Wikipedia is, I'm like, I wouldn't say I'm a hardcore libertarian, but I'm libertarian, or I tend to be on a lot of topics. And I think that Wikipedia should actually be a nonprofit or some type of like owned by the government, and should be like a national treasure that.
Yeah, the Department of Education should just own Wikipedia and fund it through, you know, what is the, look up the Department of Education funding, and I bet that would cover, you know, easily what Wikipedia needs to stay around. And it's doing a hell of a lot more than the Department of Education probably is.
Isn't Wikipedia already a nonprofit?
It might be a nonprofit, but I want to make sure it never goes out of business. I think that Wikipedia is a treasure. And right. same with Reddit. I'm like, Reddit don't make money. You don't need to make money. Well, you just ask, put a little donation thing and just let us see your expenses and I'll just give you a little bit and everyone will. It's like one of the few things where I'm like, donation or government funded is the way to go.
Right on. Okay. I want to give people in the last 4 minutes. Oh my God. Department of Education, $68 billion in funding. Yeah. They can afford to
fund. How much you think Wikipedia, I don't even know. I mean, if you have 5 billion page views a month, how much?
Well, they say on their thing, we need this much to survive. I don't know what it is, but it's like, I don't think it's above 2 billion. I don't think it's.
I don't even know. Like that. What do you think Twitch costs to run? Like
well,
if you had no
know,
people.
So I can't say.
Okay. If I, or just for the hosting, like I'm ignorant. I know nothing. Does it cost more than 10 million? Do you think it would cost more than 10 million a month?
Yes. But I can't say about Twitch, but I would just say
Wikipedia. Yeah. You think Wikipedia costs more than $10 million a month just in hosting?
I think it's probably about that. That'd be my guess.
So maybe they need $200 million a year.
AWS could just fund it and be like, hey, this is powered by AWS. It could be on every page. Powered by AWS, get free hosting that way.
Wikipedia's funding is around $100 million a year. Right. There it is.
Okay, so let's give them one more idea before we go because we talked about a bunch of random topics today. Okay, business idea. So I just got my new house and I'm renting this place. And as part of it, you need renter's insurance. And so I'm like, oh, fuck, here's a task I don't want to go do.
You got to go get lemonade.
Yeah, I got to go do whatever. But then I was thinking about it. I was like, and the guy who's telling me I need renter's insurance is the broker, the agent who like rented me the house. And I was like, why isn't this just part of the lease where like, you're like, hey, by the way, check this box because you need renter's insurance and just do it through me. And you have your renter's insurance done. And so obviously this guy's not an insurance company, but what I think you could do is create a back office insurance company where the storefront is actually just all the rental agents and brokers that already are talking to the customer, just signed the deal. They're the ones trying to enforce these terms and force you to have insurance. Why aren't they empowered? So I'll give you an example of this. I have a buddy named Guy Gal. Great name. Fucking top five name.
Guy and Gal?
Guy Gal is his name.
Oh, that's great.
And Guy has this company called Gal. Rise, I believe, is the name of the company. And what he does is he's like, hey, you know all these, when you go to sell a house and the sign goes up and it's like Coldwell Banker or like whatever, KB Homes or whatever it is. It's like always the brokerage name and then like the agent is kind of like a very secondary footer thing. He's like, dude, the world is shifting where the agents really want their own brand up front. The agents are the one who go do the marketing, the sales. So what he did was he's like, and the brokerage takes a huge fee. So when an agent gets their fee, I think the brokerage would take 50%. And so he's like, look, through technology, I can make a more streamlined brokerage. And what I could do is I can be a hidden back office for any agent. So you're the agent, your name is Alex, you know, Alex Rompero. Well, you could just be the Rompero Group and you could build your brand as the storefront. Forget Coldwell Banker. You don't need those guys. I will be the back office. I'll take care of the legal compliance and paperwork that the brokerage normally does. And I will only charge you X percent fee. And it's less than the 50% that
isn't this that exactly what Coldwell Banker does?
Coldwell Banker does it, but they are the back office, but they put their brand first. And a broker can try to like kind of put their own marketing front on top, but it's not their core model and they take a huge cut. So what this guy did, what he did with Rise is really smart. He targeted the top 1% of agents in every market. He goes to them. He said, dude, you're a top 1%. You don't need Coldwell Banker. You are the brand. And he said, bring your book of business to me. I'll do the same work that they do for you with the lower cut. And I'm going to, and look, you push a button, your website gets spun up automatically. I'll take care of all your sort of technology needs. And I take 15% instead of 50% or whatever it is. And so I think it's a really smart model. He's doing really, really well.
How much money is he doing?
I can't say, but the company's doing well. And I think it's a really smart model attacking a very big space, which is this back-end brokerage thing for home sales. I think you could do the same thing for insurance. I think you could build an invisible insurance company and have the brokers or the agents be the storefront and just say, hey, you should just offer this to all your clients when they rent from you or buy from you. I know that Compass kind of did this in the real estate space, but there's someone doing this for business insurance where they're trying to be a back office as a service.
I've seen
I think there's more companies that can do this that are not doing this today, where you empower the agent who is already at the point of sale and you give them a thing to upsell that gives them a little bit of money, and it makes your customer acquisition free. And you just need to provide the back end service for it. So I think there's a whole class of businesses like this.
Yeah, I need to go and research all this. This interests me a lot. I'm gonna go look up Caldwell Banker. I see their signs. I don't even know what they do entirely.
Yeah, deep dive it and deep dive Compass because they kind of disrupted this.
Yeah,
model
and they crush
bit.
It.
All right, I gotta run my computer batteries at 1%.
Cool. I'm gonna shut my computer. I gotta go. See you.
Me too. See ya.